Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find the time to sit down and make progress on a book you've been trying to read. Tell me about it. I've got two kids. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books, distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You'll still get the most important takeaways and the crucial information from each book, but it'll be so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting or at the gym or on your way to work or in between podcasts. Now look, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. So why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist totally free and get access to their library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/ROF. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. On today's show, Peter Gowan from Jacobin Magazine will join us to discuss a plan to win socialism in America. Chauncey DeVega from Salon will be here to explain why it's a myth that uneducated white voters support Trump because of economic anxiety. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to help me run down all the major political headlines from a very busy week in news. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. If you like the show, support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, this week, another crazy week in the Donald Trump era. Let's start with what's happening on the crime blotter side. And we should also speak about tough week for Nancy Pelosi to dismiss the concept of impeachment, but we will get to that later in the program. This week, we saw Paul Manafort stand in front of a judge in Washington, D.C., one that was a little bit less cynical or critical of the idea of white-collar crime, I think. She sentenced him to 3.5 years in prison. This is on top of his other about 4 years, more or less, that he received, I guess, now a week or two ago. And this was for his fraud and conspiracy. She made a point of saying that she was not ruling on the question of collusion. This was not brought up. And that, to me, was a direct message to Donald Trump. Don't do to me what you did to the last judge in terms of trying to spin this. But what was also amazing about that moment was not just that Paul Manafort at age 69 is going to go to prison for seven some odd years, or ostensibly will, but what happened almost literally seconds later, which was an announcement from New York City. Why don't you pick it up from there? Because the implications of this are fascinating, and we have certainly speculated about this for years as to whether there were other charges that could sort of, protect the initial federal charges from a Trump pardon.
Well, that's right. And the fact, I mean, it's looking more and more like this pardons issue is very central to what's happening. And I don't mean that necessarily just in terms of the Mueller investigation, or although clearly it impacts it, because if there were charges to be made in that, I think the dangling of pardons, which, by the way, Richard Nixon was charged with in impeachment articles back in the 70s, that would clearly be something that would fall under, you know, obstruction of justice, abuse of power. However, we don't know that yet, whether any of that's coming down the pike. But just from what we can see visibly, Trump has been dangling pardons to various players in this, and basically all players, right? Because he goes public with it. He does this on his Twitter feed. He does this. And so it's very interesting to have seen Manafort's lawyers actually just pretty much come right out. I mean, they came out of the case in Virginia right after the judge, who had, by the way, said nothing about collusion or any of that in his sentencing, despite the fact that he was very sympathetic to Manafort, obviously, and hostile to the Mueller investigation. He didn't say anything about collusion. The lawyers came out, and their statement immediately was, in this case, it was not shown that there was any collusion. There was no collusion. They used the exact words that Donald Trump does, and Trump then parroted that the next day to the press. And he, of course, lied and said that the judge had agreed with that, although he hadn't. Now, the same thing happened in the D.C. courtroom where Manafort was sentenced on Wednesday. And the lawyers again came out and said the same thing. I mean, you can't be any more obvious than that they are looking to Trump for pardon, which is, you know, the fact that the New York DA's office came out instantly. I mean, obviously they had it prepared. They just hit send,
right,
and that was it. To, you know, basically just kind of put up a big blaring, you know, stoplight on this and say, go, you know, basically they're saying to the president, go ahead, pardon him. You know, his troubles aren't over. If you think that's actually going to make a difference, and I don't think it's specific just to Manafort. I think the idea is to sort of make it clear that Trump, you know, if he decides to use this pardon power to try and cover up, which he clearly is trying to do, but if he yep. actually, you know, trips that wire, there are going to be consequences. You know, it's not all these people have, you know, various exposure, not just in New York. Manafort has exposure in Virginia, too. He's got exposure in California, Florida. There's a whole bunch of places in the United States where these people have got, you know, they're criminals. They're all a bunch of criminals. So, you know, they're all exposed. And so it just kind of just sends out this message immediately that, no, you're not just going to be able to get away with murder here. And we're going to, you know, the sort of the defenders of law and order on various levels are, whether or not they're consciously coordinating together or whether or not this is just, you know, they can see what's going on and they're deciding to take action, they're making it clear that that's not going to, it's not going to, they're not going to make it easy for him. Let's just put it that way.
Well, yes. And so, I mean, it's fascinating. Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan district attorney, came out and said and announced 15 sealed indictments that deal with fraud and other issues. These are state charges, like you said. They are inoculated against a federal pardon from the president. And there's so much that's fascinating about this. One, it is clear that there was some measure of coordination, right, in this announcement. Now, I don't know. I imagine that prosecutors on a federal level and a state level certainly can communicate and can coordinate. I don't think there's any issues with that. But they made a conscious decision to have there be virtually no time between the Manafort sentencing and this announcement. It seems to me the timing, and I think you're right about this, is specifically to preclude a pardon by Donald Trump, right? Because now Trump, if Trump was planning to pardon, which I think it's quite obvious he was, he has to wait to find out about the disposition of these city charges, because there's no value to him to pardon Paul Manafort if Manafort is still looking at 5-10 years more to go to prison, because Manafort's going to, if he wants to if Manafort wants to get himself off the hook, he's going to have to provide actual material. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't think Paul Manafort is going. I don't think the idea of, let's just hypothetically say, amongst those 15 indictments that maybe he's looking at 10 years, maybe he's looking at a lot more. But I don't think he's saying to himself, well, 10 years is so much better than 17 that I'm going to keep my mouth shut for a pardon on the seven. I have a feeling Paul Manafort, this is sending a message to this basically freezes Donald Trump. Like you say, it sends a message to Paul Manafort, and it sends a message to any other players out there that Mueller, the Southern District of New York, they know what they're doing. And they understand. And just because, you know, we've been asking for 2 years, are there going to be parallel charges on a state level? And and it's been relatively quiet. And it's been an open question. Well, now that question is resolved, and it creates an entirely different reality for those people who might turn on Donald Trump, regardless of what the question is. I mean, even folks who are, skeptics about the collusion and whatnot. Donald Trump seems to have been running a criminal enterprise in New York State. But let's take a break. We'll talk more about this on the other side. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio, talking to the great Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, we were talking on the other side about the Paul Manafort sentencing and then just immediate announcement by the DA in New York City, Cyrus Vance, as to fraud and conspiracy charges against Paul Manafort. 15 indictments, which could theoretically lead to many, many years in prison. And it has the effect of freezing Donald Trump's potential pardon of Paul Manafort. It has the effect of saying to Paul Manafort, hey, you know that whole thing where you were lying to us when you had made an agreement to tell us the truth and you were feeding information to the Trump administration and you want to stay out of jail? Well, we got some bad news for you. Donald Trump is not in a position to save you from jail time at this point, or theoretically. And it sends a message to who knows who is, you know, who else they might be sort of holding back from either the Southern District of New York's or the Mueller investigation or any of the other parallel investigations with the hopes of a pardon from Donald Trump. Donald Trump's not having a very good week, is he?
He certainly isn't. And I think what you just said, the last part is very important, which is you said, you know, it sends a message. Ask yourself, who is the person or what organization is most exposed to charges from New York State and the city of Manhattan besides Paul Manafort? And I have to say, it's Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. And we know that the Southern District is looking very hard at the Trump Organization right now. They're looking at the inauguration. There's also all this, you know, we don't know for sure, of course. We haven't seen a lot of details come out. But it's pretty clear that they are looking at the Trump Organization now. And, you know, Trump, he's got people like Alan Weisselberg. There's all these people who are going to be called before Congress. We heard all these names. What's the guy's name? Matt Calamari. You know, all these Trump Organization people. And essentially what's being said there, too, by the Manhattan DA, and I'm sure by Tris James, the New York State AG, is You know, Trump can pardon you on these federal charges, but don't kid yourself. You know, when it comes to all this stuff like tax evasion and money laundering and fraud, insurance fraud, and all the rest of these things, there are a ton of state charges that can pile up on all that stuff. And by the way, the legislature in New York has, you know, decided to take another look at their double jeopardy law, which, by the way, it's there, but it's kind of easily circumvented when you have this massive amount of criminality going on. There's almost always a way for the state and the city to find other avenues to they can use the information that they have from these other cases to build cases, on charges that aren't directly relating to that. So it's even with the double jeopardy law, and there's still great danger for any of these people if they're pardoned by Trump on federal charges. And it looks like the state is actually looking at getting rid of them, getting rid of this double jeopardy law. So, you know, this is very, very dangerous moment for Donald Trump, because today what was shown is, on Wednesday, it was shown that they had, that the state of New York and that other portions of the law enforcement community were looking at all of these crimes and were there prepared to serve as a backstop in case he decides to abuse his power to pardon. And by the way, just one more thing on this pardon thing. You know, the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, when he was, you know, we know that he has a grave he has grave concerns about the idea that the president is obstructing justice by trying to interfere with the Justice Department investigations. It seems weird to me, but that does seem to be his position. He's one of those people who's very into the, you know, unlimited presidential power. But they asked him specifically about pardons in his testimony, and they said if it were shown that someone offered a pardon in exchange for testimony of some sort, would you consider that to be within the presidential purview? And he said, no, that would be a crime. Now, whether or not you can prove that Trump and his henchmen directly did that is difficult. Because they, as Michael Cohen said, they speak in code. But nonetheless, this is how, mob cases are put together, where they are able to prove the mob boss did, or not prove, depending on what's there. So, even on that level, there are limits, even for William Barr, about dangling pardons. To me, it seems obvious. If you look at Trump's tweets and comments over the past 2 years, he has been out there dangling pardons freely, basically, sure. Saying it. I mean, there's just no other way to interpret what he's saying. So, we'll have to see where this goes. But this pardon issue is for real.
Oh, I think it's huge. I think it's huge. Yeah. And the real, the real question to me is, to what extent did the Trump defense team, what awareness did they have that there could be parallel charges against Manafort? And what do they do next? Right. I mean, it's I think I said earlier 15 counts. I think it's 16 counts of everything from mortgage fraud, conspiracy, falsifying business records, scheme to defraud. There's a whole host of different charges in there. I'm not clear what the minimums would be for those charges, but surely, he's looking at a significant amount of time, certainly the potential for as much as he's already going to be serving. So we will have to wait and see what happens. But Digby, we got to take a quick break. Can you join me in the next hour? We'll be right back.
Absolutely.
Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, exposing the myth that uneducated white voters support Trump because of economic anxiety. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Folks, you should hear what you are missing. You're missing 2/3 of the show. More great interviews, more great analysis of this week's news. Check it out. You can get it all for just literally pennies a day. Two-thirds more of the show at ROFpodcast.com. Your membership keeps this show alive. Plus, you'll get access to our over 10 years' worth of archives with some amazing interviews from some big luminaries on the left. Check it out, ROFpodcast.com. Meanwhile, as always, thanks for listening. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. A recent study by the University of Kansas sociologist David Smith and Eric Hanley shows how a combustible mix of racism and sexism in combination with anger and bullying put the United States on a path to authoritarianism. Here to discuss, Chauncey DeVega from Salon. So, Chauncey, there's been a narrative that started probably sometime on November 9th that 2016, that of what drove the very narrow win by Donald Trump. And just to remind everyone, not only did Donald Trump lose the popular vote, but he won by less than 70,000 votes spread out across three different states. I think everyone across the spectrum agrees that there were multiple but-fors, if you will, as to what brought about the loss by Hillary Clinton. They range really across the board, you know, things that she had no control over, things that were, you know, maybe nefarious, other things that were more banal in terms of, you know, deficits in campaigning, deficits in policy, the nature of her as a candidate, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need to relitigate those things per se, but people want to know because people want to defeat Donald Trump. And people also want to know, you know, what led to this real joker in many respects becoming the president of the United States. And I've spoken to people who basically have described that election as two people racing to lose the election. And it just so happened that Clinton got there first. And that may have changed if there was more time. But one of the narratives that came out of this was that there was something particularly, and part of that was because Trump won in Wisconsin by maybe a dozen, you know, 1,000, 10,000 or so votes. In Michigan, a similar number, between 7 and 15,000. And then in Pennsylvania, 40,000. States that are known as, you know, purplish states, with a white working class that supposedly defected from Obama to Trump. And the idea was that people were focusing on the working class part of that white working class as opposed to the white part of that white working class. This is a narrative that has been, you know, repeated. And I think it's, you know, there's a certain amount of motivated reasoning to it. But there's a new study out that, again, shows that, frankly, not the case. It's more the white stuff that's more operative.
Well, yes. I mean, there's so much excellent research at this point. And as you pointed out so sharply, the mainstream corporate media especially, but many Democrats, and I'll throw Bernie in there as well, are beholden to this lazy narrative about the quote-unquote white working class. It was working class anxiety. It was globalization. It was deindustrialization. Certainly those are factors which have devastated not just quote-unquote Rust Belt America, but inner city black and brown America. But we have a recent article called The Anger Games, Who Voted for Donald Trump in the 2016 Election and Why, which just appeared in the journal Critical Sociology, which is just another nail in the coffin, which shows it wasn't working class anxiety, because in America, you can't talk about class without talking about race. It was racism. It was racial resentment, and it was a concept we know as hostile sexism, this belief that men, in particular white men, should always be dominant, and this anxiety and hostility towards women who were perceived as breaking rules of tradition, i.e. being too independent, like Hillary Clinton. And I think the narrative persists because you have so many in the chattering class and many liberals and progressives who are not in the chattering class, who are not part of the mainstream corporate media, who don't write about these topics for a living, who are beholden to this belief in human decency. and to basically say the fact that Trump's election was about racism and white backlash, and you had a overt at this point racist in Donald Trump and everybody around him basically telling angry white folks that we're going to put you back on top. And that black guy who was president, we're going to have a corrective. Make America great again really means make America white again. And that's why Trump won.
The glib response to that has been, how do you explain people who vote for a black president and then turn around and vote for Donald Trump? Out of racism, what is the response to that type of critique of the narrative that Donald Trump won because he activated some type of racism in folks?
Well, there are very few Obama to Trump voters. We know that empirically from exit polls. And the simple response would be that a lot of these racially resentful white and not just men, women, female voters voted for Trump. Rather, they voted for Obama despite the fact he was black. Right. So we can actually go back and look at the polling data. Obama's race, the color of his skin, actually cost him about 4 to 5 percentage points. Obama certainly was extremely competent, one of, I would suggest, best presidents in recent memory. But if you look at the economy, if you look at the disaster that was the Bush presidency, you had white working class voters, quote unquote, in these areas basically saying, you know what, I am not too fond of black and brown folk, and I'm going to vote for Obama despite the fact that he's black. So then you have Trump come along, who doesn't use dog whistles. He uses racial air raid sirens to basically speak to those voters and say, I will protect you. I will save you. We have black and brown folks coming from Latin and South America who are rapists and murderers. I'm going to put white men like you, never mind the fact that he's a billionaire, supposedly, I'm going to put you on top. And here's something else to think about. We just had some new data about these Trump voters who supported Bernie Sanders. So you had a lot of these Trump voters in these areas who voted for Bernie in the primaries. And guess who they voted for when they had a choice between Hillary and Trump? They voted for Trump. So even their support for Bernie was a protest vote of sorts. So the evidence, again, suggests that it was race and racial resentment and not, quote unquote, working class anxiety. But that story is so compelling, and it's so easy, and it's low hanging fruit.
Well, now we should say, in fairness, that the defectors from Sanders, at least in the context of the Democratic Party, to Donald Trump, was at least, you know, based on studies by Washington Post, lower than we've seen, let's say, in the 2000 race from folks who voted for Clinton and voted for Obama. Nevertheless, I think one of the things that we also know from research, and I don't know if how much folks are familiar with this book by John Sides and Michael Tesler and Lynn Vavreck about what Barack Obama did to the electorate in terms of making them aware of where the relative parties were on race. I mean, one of the things that came out of that book that I found stunning was data that showed that it wasn't until Barack Obama's election that white working folk without a college education, 50% of them thought that the Republican Party was to the left of the Democrats when it came to race. And it took an African-American president to be elected for these folks to realize, like, wait a second, the Democrats seem to be more supportive of people of color in this country. And that turns out to be problematic. I mean, so what Barack Obama did in many respects was just by the fact of being a black president, was to racialize a lot of things that hadn't been racialized at that point. And you can see that graph, through Mitt Romney, who, of course, was no champion of the working class, right? I mean, that's one of the things that people don't consider, that Mitt Romney, that the vast majority of people who voted for Donald Trump, I mean, we're talking in the 90s, also voted for Mitt Romney. Not exactly the working man's hero. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Chauncey, let's dig more into this and what it says about who should we be looking at if we're interested in who has a better chance of winning in a general election once we have the knowledge that there's a significant portion of the American electorate who is somewhat racist and somewhat misogynist. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, one of today's sponsors, BetterHelp.com/ROF. BetterHelp is an online service that gives you access to your own experienced, fully licensed therapist. You can do so by way of phone, video, or text. When you see a therapist in person in their office, it about takes 3 weeks on average before you're actually able to get your first appointment. But with BetterHelp, you're matched with a therapist who fits your needs within just 24 hours. And you get the same professional service. And the best part, BetterHelp is less expensive than seeing a therapist in person. Plus, you'll have totally unlimited access to the therapist. You can talk to them whenever you want, on your phone or on your computer. And because BetterHelp believes in what they do, they have a full money-back guarantee. If, for whatever reason, you're not happy with the service, you'll get a full refund, no questions asked. All of their therapists go through an extensive vetting process and are required to have at least 3 years of experience before joining BetterHelp. So you know you're getting someone who is fully qualified to help you. But if you don't think your therapist is a good fit, BetterHelp lets you switch to someone new at any time. Get started right now by going to BetterHelp.com/ROF. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with Salon Magazine's Chauncey DeVega about his piece, Sociologists Blow Up the Myth That Uneducated White Voters Support Trump Because of Economic Anxiety. So, Chauncey, we were talking in the last segment that there's, you know, increasing evidence, and I think at this point we've had multiple studies that indicate that to the extent that Donald Trump was able to win the election in 2016, and he won it insofar as, you know, this is when you're talking about 70,000 votes over the course of three states in an election where 220 million people participate, it is in some ways a coin toss. But of course, the past two coin tosses have gone to the Republican Party when you include 2000. That the data shows that much of Donald Trump's vote was a vote against was a vote that was inspired by race, was inspired by, or I should say, racist beliefs. So it was inspired by a misogyny. Hillary Clinton came out and made her had to, in many respects, talk about race more than Barack Obama did. And of course, I think, and I have a theory, and I want to get your take on this, that from the perspective of a racist and a misogynist, those aren't two different things. That they look at Hillary Clinton running for president and they say, wait a second, we gave them one non-normal president. We're not going to have two non-normal presidents in a row. We need to revert back to the mean, which is the white guy. Here's my question to you. As people who are interested in Donald Trump not winning again, how do we take that information? Does that implicate our decision as to who we think should be the nominee for the Democratic Party?
I mean, I've been going back and forth on this, and I'll stake my flag on this one. I'm a Joe Biden supporter. I think in this context, never mind the fact that Hillary won by millions of votes, never mind it was stolen, never mind the Electoral College, we go down the list. And I say that because the Democrats are making a huge mistake, and a lot of folks who, again, are not looking at Donald Trump as a cultural problem. Trump is not just a president. He's a cultural problem, right? So Trump is literally the embodiment, never mind of kleptocracy and plutocracy, of racism, white supremacy, misogyny, and bigotry. And until you understand that Trump leads a political cult, the Democrats are going to make poor decisions in terms of how to fight him. All right. So I say in this context, to neutralize a lot of the ammo he's already going to have lying around, I think Joe Biden is probably the most practical candidate. I actually think he's probably going to be the one with the highest chance of winning, because in this context, we need a white man to take out another white man. And going back to the cultural point, I mean, there's some other really, really important information, new research that should have been all over the news. So there's some findings out there, new research article in Sociology Journal, which highlight how white Americans in this sample size, in terms of the research, when you actually prompt them with information about America's changing racial and ethnic demographics, quote-unquote browning of America, whatever you think about it, that they are less supportive of democracy if they are made to feel or believe or shown data that shows that white folks may not be the majority group. So literally, we have millions of white Americans, Trump supporters and others, who say, damn democracy if my group's not in charge. And that's what the Democrats are up against.
Now, if the theory is that that Trumpism, not just Trump, should be defeated, what happens to a Joe Biden in the primary when people look back on his record? When we're talking about his record in the Senate, he had a fairly poor record when it came to race back in the day. This is a guy who entered in. Into the Senate, bragging that he was perceived himself to be a conservative. He had there's going to be a lot of women in the Democratic Party who remember that the reason why Anita Hill was the only person to testify against Clarence Thomas was because Joe Biden prevented three women who had had some degrees of stories that were similar to Anita Hill's. Joe Biden's going to have, or let me rephrase that. Do you think Joe Biden's going to have a problem that he needs to prove to the Democratic primary voters that those were that he doesn't have a problem in regards to women or in regards to race? I mean, it's one thing, you could serve with a vice president who's black. You can have a friend who is black. But I mean, if you're out there talking about busing back in the day, you don't necessarily have a long term record on these issues. Biden, was talking about Barack Obama was a special candidate because he was so articulate and phrased it in a way that a lot of people found to be a little bit dicey. What do you say in terms of Biden and his ability to get through the Democratic primary without addressing those things in a way that may trigger the same type of response that a Hillary Clinton did?
Well, I mean, you're spot on there, especially Biden's comments about reparations. So certainly, like any other candidate, he's going to have a ton of baggage on these issues. So he's going to need to speak plainly and clearly. But here's the old puzzle, right, in terms of thinking about elections. So you're going to have your primary voters who are going to be keyed in. They're politically aware, right? They're by definition more invested in politics. They have higher levels of political knowledge. They're going to respond to one set of issues, right? So you have to pass that bar. But we need to have a candidate for the Democrats who can win the general election. And here's another complicating factor in terms of thinking about how do the Democrats position themselves against Donald Trump. He's a cultural force, number one. And number two, well, the political parties are pretty well sorted now in terms of racial animus. You alluded to it earlier. The Republican Party, for the last 50 years, at this point, conservatives and racism are fully one and the same thing, from the Southern strategy to Trump. And we actually have a lot of good empirical data that shows that racially resentful and outright racist white voters, well, they're fully sorted into the Republican Party, right? So we're not going to get them. So don't worry about trying to get these white working class voters. So the issue becomes, how do we mobilize the base to have the turnout? Because, again, Hillary won by 3 million. How do we secure our voting and electoral system? But I do think, again, in the final analysis, the average voter, the general election, they're really not going to care about these issues in the same way that primary voters are.
Well, when you look at, like, say, Wisconsin, right, in Michigan, and you had a depressed African-American turnout because they saw someone like Hillary Clinton and they did not feel that she would address their issues. And when you have Joe Biden, and if I don't know if Donald Trump has this type of savvy, but if he wants to go out there and start saying, Joe Biden is the one who brought you the bankruptcy bill, and I love bankruptcies and I think people should have the same rights. I mean, if he starts talking about, Joe Biden, senator from, credit card companies, and talks about Joe Biden's, in attempts to depress Joe Biden's turnout in the same way that maybe, the super predator comments by Hillary Clinton depressed the turnout among people of color. What happens in that scenario?
Well, I mean, the polling data again shows us, and we know tons of empirical evidence and data on this, that African Americans as a group are remarkably politically sophisticated. So I would not be too concerned about that. Here's what the Democrats got to do. Trump is the issue. You run on Trump. You go to black and brown folks and say, this man hates you. Use that language. This man wants to deport your family. This man wants to put you in prison. This man says neo-Nazis and white supremacists are very fine people, right? So you run on those issues. You run on his very own words, right? So Trump, in a lot of ways, he's an existential threat to this country. I've been on the record saying that to this country's democracy. And he's just version one. I'm more concerned about version 2.0 and version 3.0, mm-hmm. right? Once you get some polish on this monster, right? He's the floor model.
Right.
But do you think you can use Trump, his language, his rhetoric, and frame it to black and brown folks who already know this? We know this. This man is an existential threat to this country, to this democracy, and to our safety and security. And
well,
I think that's going to be the mobilizing factor.
Chauncey DeVega, thanks for your time today. I hope that works better this time around than it did the last time around in 2017 or 2016. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Chauncey DeVega is a political writer for Salon and the host of the Chauncey DeVega Show. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.